Do you work in public services? Have you and your team made a difference this year? The Guardian Public Services Awards reward innovation and best practice across all public services. If you're making your sector more innovative, efficient, and imaginative, enter now to get the recognition you deserve. For more information and to enter, visit guardian.co.uk/public services awards. The deadline is midnight on Friday, the 12th of July. Terms and conditions apply.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Modern politicians, at least according to the conventional wisdom, are all the same. They did the same course at the same university, followed by the same career path through the think tanks, law offices or consultancy firms, and all end up looking and sounding the same. But Labour's Alan Johnson did none of these things. Orphaned at 13, he left school at 15 to stack shelves. After working in the postal services and as a union official, he became an MP in the Blair landslide of 1997 and was then promoted to the Cabinet, where he was variously Secretary for Work and Pensions, Trade and Industry, Education, Health, and finally at the Home Office under Gordon Brown. And I ought to be completely upfront and clear about it, I worked for him for a decent chunk of that time, so I'll endeavour to be especially brutal to avoid any bias. Alan, you're while your colleagues left the Cabinet and were off writing a journey, or the third man in Peter Mandelson's case, maybe it was the fourth man in Alistair Darling's, I don't know, but you didn't decide to write the fifth man. You did something different.
Yes. Having reflected on what I should do, my agent talked about memoirs, political memoirs, but you know the field is rather overcrowded for the reasons you've mentioned. I've kept a diary since I was about 25, but when I looked at them, I wondered whether anyone would be interested in, you know, me getting up and going and doing the number 16 postal delivery to Arcacia Avenue. And there's this story about my mother and my sister that I thought ought to be told. My sister had done some stuff, she's a few years older than me, about the kind of chronological order of everything and the things that she remembered, much of which I don't remember because she was that bit older. So that was the kind of skeleton on which to do this memoir.
And, I mean, interesting there, right at the beginning, you sort of talk about the two women, your mother and your sister, and the book really is a sort of testament to the extraordinary work they did in bringing you through safely, first of all, your mother and latterly, after she died, your sister, as you say at the beginning, in keeping you safe. And there's two things that I think drop out of that into politics potentially. One is feminism. Are you a feminist? It's not normally a question we ask of men.
Yes, I would consider myself to be a feminist. And I think without the feminist movement, which sometimes gets derided, you know, from women on the left now, which I find surprising. But, you know, I started work when I represented telephonists. If you were a man, you couldn't be a day telephonist. And if you were a woman, you couldn't be a night telephonist. And if you were a civil servant, there was something called the marriage bar. And everyone in the post office then was a civil servant. You got to a certain grade and you couldn't move beyond it if you were a woman who was married. I mean, that seems incredible now, but this is the 1960s. The 1960s was the start of the erosion of it. But the book describes how my mother, as an abandoned woman, having had the vote for about 20 years, you know, wasn't even considered fit enough to vote until very recently, which is why my mother was a big fan of the Pankhursts. Everything around the social services, the welfare state, it was a creature of its time. It passed through the man. The man was the one who went to work. Everyone in our street, all the women went to work as well. They couldn't survive without them going to work, particularly my mother, charring and cleaning. And so that huge injustice that a woman was kind of considered worthless without a man, and was considered, if she wasn't married, she was a spinster. And if she'd been married and the marriage had broken up, generally it was her fault, which I describe in the book, which one of my uncles said, you know, we've all got our own problems. And the guy at the pub, my dad ran off with a barmaid saying it's your fault. That was a very common feature of the time.
And do you feel that, I mean, this is veering a long way away from the streets of West London you talk about there, but in the work you did in the various ministries, was I don't know what you might call the feminist or the women's agenda a big part of what you did.
Well, you and I, Mr. Clark, well remember, because you were the expert on pensions, and I kind of made my mark, I suppose, in the sense that no one had noticed I'd been appointed to the cabinet, by saying that women's pensions was a national scandal. And it was a national scandal, and some respects still is. But, you know, there has been, we did a lot, and I think Steve Webb, to do credit to him, is doing a lot as well to try and end that national scandal. But it was something that kind of leapt off the page from the first ministerial briefing that you probably prepared for me.
Sorry if this is all getting a bit chummy, listeners. The other big thing that dropped out from the family situation and into the political realm, I think, is social mobility. We've got the, you know, we've had a lot of teasing of David Cameron in the press recently, not only for being Etonian, but for widening his circle by bringing more Etonians like Joe Johnson and Jesse Norman into his inner sanctum. What do you think? I mean, do you think it's a huge problem for politics that it's got so narrow? And I don't just mean the Tory tribe. This isn't an anti-Tory point. It also extends, I think, potentially to the Labour side.
Yeah, it does, and it extends beyond politics. I mean, it is a problem in politics because you see the three leaders of the three main parties all coming off the same treadmill practically. But if you look at journalism, you know, you used to be able to kind of start on your local paper as a court reporter and then end up as an editor. I mean, that seems to not be the case now. If you look at what the Sutton Trust, Peter Lample and his people who make it their business to find out these things, the majority of reporters, never mind owners, editors, etc., now in journalism come from public schools. And that wasn't the case 30, 40 years ago. So I think it's not just politics where it's a problem. But I know what people are going to say reading the book. The book's not political, but I kind of knew when I got to the bit where me and my sister passed our 11 plus, what, you know, people on the right reading it would say, well, there you are, social mobility, which is why I describe people like Peter Hayward, my school friend, who passed it, but his parents couldn't afford the uniform, and all those kids who just on that one day, on that one test, had their future determined for them. And also the fact, I mean, it didn't do me a lot of good. I didn't get anywhere at Sloan, left school at 15, and all the rest of it. But so, you know, the obvious bit of social mobility that those who want to read something into this will say, oh, it was the grammar schools. And I don't think it was. And it's the absence of grammar schools that's responsible for what's happening at the moment.
So it's not grammar schools, but it is a real problem. And when you look at the Labour Party, I mean, it's obviously not exclusively private educated. Ed Miliband wasn't privately educated, but it is. I mean, as I am, and as a lot of people in the political world are, like people who've been to Oxford, done PP, a single course, so many politicians now have done. And not only that, they're all about the same age. And, like, do you think when you were in Hull with your constituents, do you think people think they don't know what they're talking about because they don't look like they lived?
Well, they might have always thought that. You know, there was, the credit to the trade union movement, they transformed my life around. Them and BBC Radio 4, probably more than anyone else, responsible for my education. It certainly wasn't Sloan Grammar School. So there were always people like Nye Bevan, Ernest Bevin, James Callaghan, who was the leader of the Inland Revenue Staff Federation, you know, and rose to be Prime Minister. And that seems to have stopped in the sense that, and I understand this to a certain extent, university education has expanded. You know, 4% went to university when I was born. It's expanded, and the need for a university degree has become much more common now to do anything, even get some of the senior jobs in trade unions. I mean, some, you know, elect from the bottom, sort of me, postman getting to the top. But many trade unions now, there's not the same ability to go through the system and to end up as general secretary. So I think we all have to look at that. And partly it's a good reason. There are more people getting degrees, and working class kids who get a degree, go to university, shouldn't then find a kind of reverse snobbery, an inverted snobbery, that they're not selected for Labour seats because they happen to have gone to university. I mean, crud, we didn't strive all those years to get working class kids to go to university. But for people like me who didn't go to university, it's getting much rarer to see them on those green benches.
And does it make, you've had I think it's fair to summarise the reviews to this as glowingly positive, and the question has come up of, you know, why didn't this boy go all the way to number 10? Do you feel a bit like you maybe should have done for all those people who are watching and hoping that there'd be a leader of the country that looked a bit different?
Well, I can see the romanticism of it, but no, you know, I'm very, very pleased and proud to have had 5 cabinet positions, 11 years as a minister. You know, life expectancy is about 2.5 years, I think, as a minister. And then when that was over and the electorate decided they wanted somebody else to run the country, I was perfectly happy to go off and do something else, like write the book. So I don't feel that great aching need. In fact, Lynn Barber in the Sunday Times said, never mind about Johnson being Prime Minister, it should have been his sister, Linda, who is Prime Minister. And I kind of agree with that.
So, as I say, it's mostly been positive, review-wise. And Peter Wilby, who wrote the review in The Guardian, called it handsome and eloquent, but I suspect he spoke for quite a lot of Guardian readers, quite a lot of people on the what we might call the exasperated left, when at the end of a favourable review he stuck in a line that said, many readers will want to know why, given this background, Johnson eventually moved to Labour's Blairite right. Have you got any thoughts on
that? Dear Peter, yeah, I think, you know, I've had that from other quarters. Fundamental misunderstanding of the trade union movement. I mean, and a little patronising, I have to say, although, you know, I forgive him anything for that wonderful review. When 127 trade unionists decided to form a political party in 1900, which became the Labour Party, they specifically defeated this proposition that said they should become a class party. They wanted to be a party of government, not a party of protest. And their great battle after the Bolshevik Revolution was against the communists. There were some really good communists who I grew up with, hammer and sickle tattooed on their chest. But the trade union movement were very clear and focused that the only way you can achieve your aims is not through revolution and actually, you know, having some kind of dictatorship with the proletariat. It's through the democratic process. And to engage in the democratic process, you have to attract votes from everywhere. And the only way to really change society, so Peter complains about Tony Blair. He introduced the national minimum wage. He introduced the right to be accompanied to grievance and discipline procedures, trade union recognition. For the first time, an employer can't sack people who go on strike. That's always been the case under Ghilardi and Clem Attlee and whatever. He introduced measures to say they can't do that anymore. It's illegal to sack workers just for going on strike, providing it's a balloted strike. Whole fundamentally improved schools and hospitals and all the things that working people rely upon, increased child benefit, introduced the winter fuel. So, you know, I could go on for ages. And yet Peter thinks that somehow being part of New Labour meant you were a class traitor to the kind of background I come from. You know, as I point out to Peter and to others, Ernest Bevin, who was the 12th illegitimate son of a Somerset farm worker, was one of the greatest foreign secretaries we had and a very strong voice for moderation. And moderation has always been the watchword, to quote Billy Bragg, between the wars, sweet moderation, heart of our nation, desert as not we are between the wars. Moderation has always been the fundamental principle of the trade union movement because they weren't playing at this. This was not a romantic kind of adventure like a few kids on a gap year from there, you know, going to join the swappies and, you know, lining up on a picket line. This was real. This was about changing people's lives.
All right, so that you've dealt with that side then of New Labour. I mean, obviously there'd be other people who could...
Bit of a tirade, which I have to apologise for.
Take the argument on, but as soon as we've got about 8 minutes, I won't go down the road of fat cats and all of that. But yeah. What about... I wonder if there's something else about New Labour. Because one thing that comes through the book is a kind of very big-hearted attitude to people who live a bit rough and take your chance. You've got this wonderful line after your mother dies about the guy you deliver milk with, Johnny Carter. Let's give Johnny Carter his credit. And this is just before Johnny Carter takes you into a basement and offers you a free guitar as some kind of unspoken... gesture of sympathy with you after you've lost your mother. You say, let's give Johnny Carter his credit. Perhaps he had a sideline as a legitimate distributor of musical equipment. Then again, perhaps he didn't. It's a great line, and it speaks of a kind of big-heartedness that I wonder if it was someone sometimes missing from New Labour.
I don't know.
The prison population.
But you talk, Tom, about, New Labour. I mean, New Labour was a creature of its time, but, you know, I was a Labour Party member from 1973. And so, you know, I've always railed against this cult of personality, number one. I admire Tony Blair enormously, but, you know, we weren't a load of kind of Blairite groupies. We had a life before New Labour. The big-heartedness, well, I guess the, if there was a problem with New Labour, it was 18 years of opposition. And then a short, I mean, Labour governments were short periods, interludes in Conservative rule. You know, 15 years we were out. And so the thing about Blair and Brown and when we came in 97 is we wanted to be there for long enough to make a difference, to build 3,000 Sure Start centres, introduce education maintenance allowance, all big-hearted things to do, I may say, Mr. Clark. But to carry it through, you know, you can't achieve much in one term of office and then you're out again, which was Labour's historic role. So I think there was probably a kind of almost evangelical desire to not make the mistakes of the past. And sometimes that made us look as if we were, you know, being far too dogmatic or far too draconian.
I was thinking more of the sort of, just strictly on the sort of law and order, social order kind of terrain, you know, like, you know, in your description of Johnny Carter, there's such a sort of willingness there to give someone the benefit of the doubt, give them a second chance. And I just wonder whether in sort of Asbo happy Britain of 2010, whether that had been...
It's a good point. I don't think so. I don't take it. I mean, I hope we weren't going all out for the Johnny Carters of this world. He was a kind of rascal, lovable rascal, if you like. But, you know, one of the great things that Blair recognised from his time as Shadow Home Secretary and the famous tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, so first we had to reverse the increase, which we did. It had doubled under the Tories and went down. And secondly, that the people adversely affected by crime and antisocial behaviour were what would have been called our people on council estates all over the country, which became no-go areas. You might remember the kids racing up and down in the 90s, you know, in estates in Newcastle. And so he was determined to tackle that. And I think he was absolutely right to do that and to do it in a way that gave people another chance. You know, the build-up to antisocial behaviour orders were, look, here's a chance, don't get into this route. And I think the statistics show that we actually had a lot of success with that.
Can we just ask you, while we've got you here, about when you were Home Secretary? Because just after the big period about whether the cash points were going to run out of money, was there a lot of preparation for the possible breakdown of social order, which in the end, by most people's reading, didn't arrive?
There was a bit, but I think most of what Alistair went through was a surprise to all of us in the Cabinet after it happened. I mean, remember, Alistair was told by the second biggest bank in the world, if you don't do something soon, people are going to be queuing up at cash points. Alistair said, define soon, what does you mean, next month or next week? They said in 3 hours. Now, he didn't have time to, you know, Cabinet subcommittee or get COBRA together. So that all happened with Alistair battling away there and giving us the odd report back. But there was a bit of that in preparation for a recession, because recessions normally mean rising crime. This time it didn't.
Can I just ask you then, in closing, about what this means, about what you might do next? I mean, first of all, is there going to be a second volume, a kind of barn sorting office to Marsham Street where you're Home Secretary?
Almost certainly. I mean, it finishes when I'm 18. So almost certainly my publisher's got the option on the next one, and we've been talking about that very, very recently. And then I think probably a third when, you know, long enough down the road, people to have forgotten all about me. But if I can do that Cabinet experience in a different way, rather than, and then I took forward the pensions bill, and which is kind of tedious, then I'll try and do that. But I do love the process of writing, so there's more books.
And the other thing that jumped out at me at the politically in the memoir was, you say a number of times, you know, you had the opportunity to maybe move to a garden city or a new town or something, and that wasn't something that appealed. Because we were London kids, we were determined above all else, we were sticking in London. You've been talked about from time to time as a possible mayoral contender. This would make you even more of a mayoral contender if you wanted to be.
Yeah, and if I wrote the book for political advantage, which of course I didn't, I don't think, you can never rule anything out, but I don't think that's for me. I have kind of, you know, if I was going to go for London mayor, that would mean not standing for Hull West and Heslin in 2015. I wouldn't get elected and then desert my constituency. And there's lots of great things and really exciting things happening in my constituency that I want to see through. So, you know, it's Hull over London, despite all those things I said about nasty things about Welwyn Garden City. Hull has captured my heart, and so I'm going to stick there, I think, for the rest of my political career.
I'm too kind to ask you what you do if Hull ever play Queen's Park Rangers. But
They have, and I cheered Queen's Park Rangers and lost a lot of votes as a result.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you cheered the good game.
A couple of years ago, yeah.
Okay, well, Alan, thank you very much indeed. This Boy is out now and available, as they say, from all good bookshops. I'm Tom Clark. The producer was Phil Maynard, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Do you work in public services? Have you and your team made a difference this year? The Guardian Public Services Awards reward innovation and best practice across all public services. If you're making your sector more innovative, efficient and imaginative, enter now to get the recognition you deserve. For more information and to enter, visit guardian.co.uk/public services awards. The deadline is midnight on Friday, the 12th of July. Terms and conditions apply.